was like collectively 80,000 euros. And we calculated and said, realized it's enough for 3 months. And I was like, okay, we have the 3 months to find investors. We don't really know how and where, but we have this accelerator, we have pitch events, and let's spread the word. And that worked.
Jan, it is such a pleasure to have you here as the first guest on our podcast. We know each other for quite some time and you've been a huge inspiration to me. So I'm very happy to have you here. And your journey as a person, but also with Skinuvita, getting to the market with your device is a journey that I'm personally so invested in, and that I feel is such a great lesson learned for the people out there, that I really look forward to the next discussions that we're going to have here. So before we get into all of your impact on health of patients out there, on home care, on building Skinuvita, why don't we start by framing you as a person a little bit more? And how did you, let's say, recapping the time between like your studies and moving into clinical research, what did you do before you came into clinical research? What are the lessons learned, let's say, that you would have taken from all your time before clinical research into then eventually forming Skinuvita as a startup?
First of all, it's a pleasure to be here, and I'm so humbled for what you just said. How did I get to that journey? How did it start? So before going to the founder journey, I was working as a PhD student and research associate at the University of Bremen at the Chair for Entrepreneurship. But to be honest, I never thought that I would end up in that whole area. I grew up in a very small village. Our street had 5 houses and there were a lot of farmers and a lot of different professions. But being an entrepreneur, I didn't even know what that is. So it came over time. I grew up in a small area. We were teenagers. We wanted to do parties. We did music. I was DJing. Suddenly I was booked on the other weekends. That it was my first exposure to entrepreneurship, until I was having a lot of DJ gigs. That was the first stage, so to say, until I realized what scalability means, because I was constantly tired studying during the weekend, having my gigs on the weekends. And then I thought, okay, maybe there is a more innovative and another edge to it. So then I went in the corporate world, to Airbus airplane manufacturing, then mid-sized company, and then to the Chair for Entrepreneurship. But I always had a passion, and that was always there, to create things that kind of matter to me, but also to other people, that always made me passionate to create things. And that's something consistent. And even in a highly regulated world like clinical research, there's so much you can do and the impact is so big. So that's what led me here.
And is there a point along that journey where you realized, you know what, I should give it a shot. I should jump in head first, not knowing, or maybe partially knowing, sort of like what you were going to get yourself into forming a company. Was there something that inspired you or that kickstarted that? Or was it, I don't know, something that you got exposed to during your time at the universities? What really sort of like planted a seed, if you do know whether there's something specific?
I think it's exposure to other people in the field of entrepreneurship and startups. I went to a lot of startup events, talked to a lot of other people, and was also realizing a bit how the corporate world looks like, and what was too slow for me. And I never wanted to lose my passion. And step by step, I was like, oh, this is really nice. But I didn't just want to start a company without really knowing what. I wanted to have something that's worth it, dedicating that much to it. And building up a startup is really hard. I think you need to be very conscious about what you choose to put your effort in. It does need to be perfectly planned. No startup is perfectly planned in the beginning, but still something that's worth dedicating to. And that's kind of where my patient journey came in. And the moment where I was like, oh man, you really got to do this, is that the pandemic happened. At the university, another project I had was pretty much frozen, because we didn't know what happens. Is this the end of the world, or can we continue in 2 months? Like in early 2020, was so interesting. And I used the time to write scholarship applications, and suddenly We got the first three scholarships. And then, like, I think 1 or 2 weeks later, I was invited to a pitch event in Berlin. And it was just an idea. There was nothing. We just had three scholarships approved, but we didn't start. So I pitched there, and then suddenly we won the main prize of the event. And we got offered 4 more scholarships and an accelerator program with the condition that I moved to Berlin and become part of this accelerator. And that was the moment where I was like, what more do you want? Like, this is the moment. And okay, get out of your comfort zone and start it.
Nice. And what was that original idea that you pitched there? If you also compare it, and maybe we can lead over to that, what does Skill Reader do now? How do you see that, like, what of that core idea that you pitched early still exists in the foundation of Skill Reader as it is today?
Yeah, there is the idea, but I think more relevant is the problem. What is the common problem? Because ideas change, but it can be very consistent when it is about solving a certain problem. And the problem was very, very relevant and always there. And I always wondered, why is there no solution there? And it's for people with skin diseases like psoriasis and atopic dermatitis, diseases that are no fun. And if you cannot get it under control with topicals and creams, and the next step is usually a certain type of phototherapy. It's like a radiation of the skin, and patients need to drive to clinic 4 or 5 times per week during the opening hours. So anyone who has a full-time job or who lives in a rural area or who has kids cannot do it. So there is a very effective therapy with good clinical data. And the main reason why many people don't do it is a practical reason. So it's like, okay, patients cannot go to the therapy. Can't we just bring the therapy to the patients? And then different ideas emerged. The first idea was to, okay, let's just rent out professional therapy lamps to the patients at home. Then we realized, oh, well, they could harm themselves. It's a professional therapy device. Maybe not such a good idea. Okay, we need to change. How can we make it safe? And it's like, software. If we transfer the dosage, automatically the patient cannot get an overdose. Oh, and the doctor needs to see how does the skin progression, how is it working? Is it not? Is the patient burned after a session? So, okay, telemedicine. We can transfer photos and information from patient to doctor. And it's like, okay. But then also the doctor can change the dosage and everything. And then step by step, the idea developed, but it was always about the same problem. And the problem is still the same. Like, the interesting thing is now, like, we are on the market with that and we are solving that problem. And there's still some homework to optimize. But the great thing is that now that we tackled that, now we can even think of more problems. I think bigger is like, it's maybe not only for psoriasis, atopic dermatitis, people who need the radiation therapy, but maybe even see, okay, what is the case if you get the diagnosis for the first time? Maybe you need some education, some online training, just with your lifestyle, you can change so many things. So we're thinking about expanding. And what about the most severe cases that need injections that inhibit their antibodies of their immune system? Okay, how can we help patients, you know, maybe have their lab data in one area, etc. So now it's growing, but the core foundation has always been the same. It's solving this problem and helping people with it because it just makes sense to make it accessible.
And I can completely see that in your business today. And it's a great lesson. And I never really thought of it that clearly, that the problem needs to be the consistent and you can develop a lot of ideas around it. That's really good to know.
You can have a lot of bad ideas. Starting in
that's content. True.
But the good thing is having a space to learn.
Yeah.
So because then it doesn't block you. It's not a failure because it's rather like, okay, that's what I thought is that my idea to be the solution is not the right thing to serve the purpose. So but it was a learning over like the last 5 years to not be so attached to the idea and rather like what's the purpose that you want to achieve was a big learning, yeah.
Now, we opened the topic of Skinovita and what you do now. So maybe if you could give us in a brief structured way, a little description of what exactly is it that you do. So, I mean, you're a medical device manufacturer, class 2A. So can you tell us a little bit about what is your device and sort of like what's your product, what's your labeling claim that you have for everyone that's listening?
Yeah, so we have different roles. There's the product we develop and then like an entire kind of care model that we implemented. The care model itself is about bringing this treatment to the patients And for that, we have dermatologists who supervise patients and do digital therapy plans in our software. That's the product part of it. So they have a tool and they can set the dosage plans and do the remote monitoring. The patients get their app where they can where they're guided through the treatment, but also a therapy lamp or a radiation device. We decided to not build a radiation device ourselves because they already existed. We just needed to make them home care ready. But this is also something that we integrated here. And last but not least, it's very important also that this is covered. Like, this is quite costly if you have dermatologists, specialists supervising a therapy device that is brought to the home, then an entire software system that is MDR2A certified. So that is the whole, also a lot of our work to make contracts with health insurance that cover the costs and different types of cost payers. But as a manufacturer, it is mostly the software side of things and a little bit of dosage transfer IoT to the therapy devices.
Mm-hmm. Very nice. So you have described your product, you have described the problem, and there you were with a couple of scholarships back at the beginning of a pandemic saying that, you know what, let's just do it. What came after that? Like, what were, how did you even come to find other people that were, let's say, crazy enough to go on the journey with you to say, you know what, Jan, I so strongly believe in the problem that you're describing. I need to be part of the solution. How did that come about? How did you recruit the core team that sort of like started the journey that you went on?
Yeah, it's so wonderful to find people who dedicate to that mission. And the key was talking about it. And it sounds so easy, but I lost a lot of time. I could have found this company earlier. Maybe it would have been too early, or maybe it would have been perfect because then in the pandemic we would have been already in the market. But I had some like mental blocks because, you know, such a skin disease, I had it since my childhood and it was no fun and I felt rejected many times. And it was embarrassing to talk about the disease. And then suddenly going wherever you go, talk like, I have psoriasis, it's itchy and it looks bad and you want to get rid of it and there's a treatment, but you basically need to go to the clinic every day and that sucks and just do it from home. And there needs to be a solution. I thought like, who would be passionate about it? Who, like, yes, every patient understands, but yeah, somehow I thought I underestimated people's ability to really see the value in something and dedicate to it. And once that was broken, it was rather like, where do I find the kind of people we need? Mm. So I had a business background, but we needed different skills there, complementary skills. So I needed to find software developers, designers, health economists. And that literally came from talking about it. Like our CTO, Jens, it started by being in the gym and talking to a guy there who, and I found out that he studies computer science. I was like, I have an idea. So I pitched the idea to him, but it wasn't the right thing for him, but we exchanged phone numbers. And he had a job at the university and talked to his supervisor. And that supervisor was like, oh man, I'm about to finish my PhD. It sounds really interesting. Also want to do something with purpose. Can you give me the phone number of that guy you met in the gym? And my co-founder Jens isn't the first one to approach new people. But somehow I had the gym guy pitching the startup after I pitched the startup was convincing enough for the supervisor to give me a phone call. And that's how it started. And with many other things, it was just like that, talking about it, spreading the word, and then things come to you. Not everything works, but it's also, if there is a 90% probability of failure, do it 20 times. Most likely you will find someone, you know? Even do 10 times. Statistically, it's good. Breaking that fear of rejection, fear of failure, and seeing it from a different perspective. That was the game changer in the early stage.
And then you had your initial funding, you had your initial team ready, the people that for whatever reason and from whatever background, they came together and said, you know what, we are ready and willing to contribute. But then where do you start? It feels like, so understanding the problem is great, but getting from the problem and the potential idea, knowing that it's one of probably 10, 20, 50 iterations that you need to go to get there, and building a system around it, and having in the back of the mind, there are a lot of requirements. You already mentioned it initially. Why don't you just ship the land to it? You immediately identified, it's not that easy. So how do you even approach a problem that is so large that it requires an entire multi-year development path?
Yeah.
What is the first step you take? Yeah. And was there a point where you felt, is this step too big for us to take? Or did you just say, let's take the first small step and see where it takes us?
Yeah, it can be really overwhelming. I think it was the enthusiasm and the opportunity where it's like, let's do it. It was impossible to have the overview. To be honest, we had no clue about clinical validation. We didn't even know if we're a medical product and what kind and how all that works. And also about payment systems in the healthcare system. And it was evolving at that time also. In COVID, you know, all these telemedicine solutions, also the government introduced new payment models. So where do you start? There's so much. I think the first thing was like, this was like this paralysis where a lot of coaches and consultants told us many things. And if you talk to the patent attorney, they say like, oh, don't say anything about the technology. And then you talk to the marketing guys, like you have to talk about it first. And then every specialist, I mean, it makes sense what they say in their domain. And then you're just frozen. It's like, oh, I need to do this, but I also need to do that and that. Mm. And then it's like, phew. And what helped was to think of what are the key assumptions that need to be true. So there needs to be a value for the patient. If there is no pain, it doesn't make sense. There needs to be a value for the dermatologist also to prescribe it and supervise it. There needs to be a value for the cost payer and the health insurance. It needs to be technically feasible and also in the regulatory part, doable. And there needs to be a way how to finance it. And then to say, evaluating everything at once is pretty much impossible, but going step by step, what is the most urgent thing? And then go step by step. And once you're all in, you're already all in. So there is no alternative. Right. Or you're a bit, okay, I go out. But why would you go out just because it's overwhelming? Like you can validate these things. And the thing is, whenever we had a problem and we dedicated to it, we learned a lot, we adapted. And it worked. And that was the next thing. Oh, okay, it worked. Mm-hmm. It's like, this is really critical. This might be the end. Ah, we can do it like this. And you don't have it solved overnight. So you have a lot of sleepless nights in between. We're like, oh man, we got so far. And now I don't know. Maybe this is the final thing that will in the end prevent the whole thing.
Right.
But if you're creative and the thing makes sense, and if you have a large number of people who want to dedicate and contribute to it, there's a lot of potential to find solutions. So we just continued and here we are still. You know, there's still a lot to do and there's still things where I think like, oh man, scalable sales structures. I have never set up such systems. But I already know I have great, investors, coaches, mentors, who support in that. And we already know that we have the proof of concept. Founder-driven sales works. So I have the ability to bring in profitable sales. So I just need to learn how to train other people, copy what is already in the mind. Just as an example, this is a current thing. Like, we want to scale. But this is now the new thing. Every 2 or 3 months, there's this like, this is not how it should be. And how could it be? This is the part of it.
Mm-hmm.
And you also need to be okay with always having one thing where you're unsatisfied how it is and having the enthusiasm to set that up, make it good, and leave it and do something new and have another problem.
It doesn't end. Yeah. And I'm sure it hasn't ended to this day. Yeah.
No, then you lose your ambition and then you're...
Yeah.
Then
exactly.
I think as a company, if you lose that explorative... Mm-hmm. Ambition, then it's only a matter of time until you're replaced by an innovative player who has this enthusiasm still.
Mm. So was there a first focal point for the development of Skinovita as a whole or the product itself that you focused on? Or did you say, well, we have now 2, 3, 4 people, so each one gets one area and this is how we just have to do it?
Yeah, I was thinking a lot of this about this question when there's many things to do. I think initially I always had the impulse to do many things at once, and I still have the tendency, But the learning is to do things one after the other is faster and leads to better quality. On the software side, however, there were some things that, like if you have a telemedicine system, you have, you know, a doctor and a patient, there needs to be an exchange, but you need two interfaces. But it was rarely that we put an equal focus on both interfaces. Mm-hmm. It was more like, first of all, we need a therapy plan. For that, you need the doctor tool. And there's no therapy plan. A patient app is useless. And then it was like, okay, this is good enough, but now the patient needs something. Mm-hmm. And we wanted to start a clinical trial. So we then dedicated to the patient app. When is it good enough to risk it, putting it in a clinical trial and thinking that it will lead to good enough results versus doing the clinical trial 9 months later, but maybe running out of money in between. Mm-hmm. So this is really risky. And then after the trial was like, oh yeah, but now we neglected the doctor thing. So we won't do it. So it's always jumping a bit that not everything all at once. In a small team is not possible. If we were a really large organization, we would have the team app, team therapy manager, team hardware. But if you're early stage startup, everyone is kind of doing everything and then rather focus.
And so did you feel at any point that you were always getting to the like 80-90%, which is done maybe in 20% of the time, but the really crunchy last 10%, you were piling up a lot of those? Was that ever a concern to you during the development, or did you feel, to be honest, we just need the MVP, so the minimal viable product, and that is good enough to a certain extent and we can live with that? Was there, how did you move through that? Also, I think emotional journey, because you sort of get attached to your product and you want to see it perfect, but at the same time, you need to balance it.
Yeah. So there's the what you emotionally want to do and then the rational part of it. We really forced ourselves to follow that 80-20 principle because the price of making one thing perfect was not doing three other things up to a 80% stage. And that's not so easy because you identify so much with it and you want to do things great. So you constantly have things that are not at their full potential, but for the sake of speed, you go on to the next thing. So I think this is the right way. So you need to be able to live with it. There's also one thing, which is the technical debt. So one thing is, like, especially on IT infrastructure, et cetera, if things are stacked on top of each other, I think there really makes sense to have a good foundation because it gets harder and harder and harder to correct. Mm-hmm. But on some other things, for instance, take design elements, et cetera, there it doesn't hurt so much. You can rework, you can replace an illustration, you can tweak a pitch deck later. On so many other levels, I think you need to be okay with it. But it's never forgetting and never losing like the high ambition. But it's always saying, okay, once we can afford, then we will get back to that. But now let's release this and go move forward. We need speed. Mm. It's always also the promise. And once we made it, then we make it perfect.
Exactly.
Maybe we're lying to ourselves, but... I think it's okay.
Yeah. Well, probably for you, it was also a little bit easier. I mean, I know your team, so probably maybe for Jens or for Janina, it was harder to say, let's stop at 80% than it might be for you. So probably there was also convincing on your end to say, but we need to move in that pace. Was that a more continuous conversation point or...
This is a very very typical conversation we have. Do we dedicate more time or is it good enough? And what about the other thing? What now has the higher priority? And to be honest, I don't claim to have the perfect position. I think if Jens or Janina would be sitting here, maybe they would... No, I think they would say the same. Because it's like, it's the logical conclusion over time that you get. Right. Like doing... Mm. Maxing out A comes at the cost of not doing the other things.
Right. Mm-hmm.
And I think now we got really pragmatic about things. We have a good common sense. The only thing where we need to think about is like, what are things where things stack on top of each other? So later it's harder to get back to.
Mm.
This is the thing that we need to find out.
That's a great perspective. So developing the app, you said there were many, many times when you sort of like got to a point where you said, well, we have come this far, but it feels like there is this hurdle, which we now have to really push through. And we're not sure if we're going to end up getting through it. Are there some early hurdles that you ran into, which you still recall now, that have really caused a lot of sleepless night for you? And if so, is there sort of like a theme to it, where they of similar topics, or like all regulatory elements of it, simply like external hard requirements you need to meet, or were they of mixed designs, where you basically said, well, it has to be useful to a certain extent for our customer, and I'm not sure how we can make that work while meeting XYZ requirements?
There were a lot of hurdles. And maybe I can go through the chronologically through the main things. So we had these scholarships, and it's quite comfortable to have. One scholarship line was for 12 months, the other was for 9 months. And by coincidence, one started 3 months later. So all seven ended in the same month. So you come from a position, most of us worked at the university before, so we're used to having grants or public funding, etc. So you're in the comfortable position. We didn't even found a company, also for some regulatory reasons, it was better to not found it. And then by the end of the scholarships to do it. And you have your project plan, you do things, you get your scholarships on the bank account, you can pay your bills. You will not get rich, but it's enough for rent, food, and the basic lifestyle. And then all seven scholarships ended in the same month. And we had an amazing team. And I was like, oh, but now every month we need X thousand euros. And I was like, we already knew that it will take time. And of course, in advance, we talked to investors. But at that moment, it was like, okay, we are not rich. Our parents don't have that money. And we don't have an established investor network. And banks are not funding that kind of things. They're not really understanding what is needed to bring it to market. It's too risky for them. And then we said, okay, let's invest everything we have. It was collectively 80,000 euros. And we calculated and said, realize it's enough for 3 months. And I was like, okay, we have 3 months to find investors. We don't really know how and where, but we have this accelerator, we have pitch events, and let's spread the word. And that worked. And that was wonderful. And that's how GCP Service came in. And as an early stage startup investor, but also as someone who gave us so many insights and coached us so much, this was so valuable. But the question, will we get funding, was fundamental at that stage. Also, until the end of the scholarships, there was nothing to lose. The moment we invested everything, that was, at least financially, everything gone.
That's it.
Yeah. No one dies, but still, going bankrupt is not so nice. And that was one point. Then the second point came a bit later, which was when we handed in everything for the clinical trial. We had to face German/European bureaucracy. And we had to wait so long for approval. And if there's an established company that is profitable, it is okay, they can wait.
Right.
But we had the salaries to pay. So every month, every week costs us money. And we're like, it cannot fail because of that. No. So also we got more and more persistent. And
This was horrible. From there.
Also, it doesn't help any. Why? And we had it twice, such a situation. One thing for approving the clinical trial, and our therapy has a seasonal component. So we lost almost an entire season. And it happened later, after the clinical trial, we had it for the MDR certification. I mean, we thought, oh, now we have clinical data, now we get the certificate in the next 2 months, and then we can start. It was 1,000 pages of tech doc, including all the clinical trial data, but also the technical documentation, the risk management, the quality management, then the audits. And we submitted everything. In the end, we had no major non-conformities. So we had really smooth submission. But between submission, we handed in everything. Here it works. And getting the certificate, it took a year. A year of paying people, a year of also, we couldn't really do marketing. We developed the product further. So therefore now with market entry, we had really well developed and polished product. But that was so frustrating. And again, we had this thing but this we came so far and this is such a stupid reason to fail. Like, no.
Yeah.
No. We are allowed to fail if no one wants to have it and we're on the market, but not because an institution doesn't have time for us.
Mm.
And that person is now sick and there is no sick leave deputy. And then right. it's that person is 4 weeks on holiday and then that person's really busy. And like now I'm making this up, like our auditor is amazing. The problem is they're just overloaded.
Yeah.
There are far more requests than auditors. But
right.
Now those were moments where
mm.
I was like, but we didn't, no, we, it was not an option. Fail because
right.
of that.
Right.
No.
Right.
No. It makes me so angry because I know that innovations die because of that. And it's so stupid. There are things mm-hmm. that could help other people, and just because of the long waiting times, they go bankrupt in between.
So. Yeah. I know that, you know, we were very personally invested in especially the clinical trial part. But of course, also, you know, we were chatting a lot in the time when you were waiting for the audit to finally move through, and especially knowing that now in hindsight, you know, everything was fine. So it just the waiting time for no impact. And the same was true when we had the BfArM application for the trial. And at the end of the day, the only reason you had to wait is because they found a legal loophole where they disagreed with the risk classification for no reason and accepted it at the end of the day anyway. And it was such a clear cut case that the lamp is defining your risk, and so it's 2As. So yes, BfArM doesn't need to look at it. That to this day, I do not understand why there was any pushback and why we had, you know, dozens of calls, and the inflexibility also was striking. I know we discussed just going there and giving them like a demonstration and just sitting down with them. If they would only listen, we would have been happy to accommodate anything. You know, but at the end of the day, you're on the short end of a stick.
And this is a startup thing. So as a startup, you don't have a lot of leverage. You don't have your army of lawyers. Mm. Maybe you're a bit younger. Maybe you're more inexperienced and therefore not as energetic or not as, persistent mm-hmm. because you're afraid of, mm-hmm. you know, losing their sympathy because mm-hmm. you have many right. moments there's one person, especially in the regulatory, one person who is like,
mm-hmm. yeah,
has all the power about the entire thing.
Mm.
And this dependency is really, and if the person doesn't even talk to you or, you know, exactly. or they have other things and you're just not important to them, that's really frustrating. Yeah. Now, maturing as a company, we have less of this dependency. This is mm-hmm. really good. But as a startup, this is, you have these situations where you're just like, okay, how can I get this person to look at it in a timely manner? How can I speed it up? Should I put pressure on the person or should I be really sympathetic? What should I do? And then also in the timeline, expect, okay, this is the legal deadline until they need to respond. Yeah. So I expect that they do it within their own deadline. And then, oh no, they found a way how to play on time.
Exactly.
You need good business angels. And GCP service. Like, there was one phone call that made the difference. And it was not by me, but from your side.
Yeah.
And that helps a lot as a startup, being backed and having people who believe in you, also on a shareholder and partnership level.
Mm.
And I also have to say this, that's how I perceive also GCP service as an institution. It is one thing is your business and what you do, but it's also the high conviction where you really go in and it's common sense. You're just like, I will not tolerate this.
Yeah.
It makes sense and we need this clinical trial and people will benefit from it. Yeah. And now we do over hours and go to it. And this is what I appreciate so much also about this partnership.
Yeah. I mean, at the end of the day, you know, you visited our team, you gave presentations on like, this is what we do. And we feel you as a person, we feel you as a company, and we love those relationships where it makes it easy for us to personally be invested in the joint journey and feel like we are part of it and we can actually contribute. And then it's so apparent of the negative impact that you have if things go wrong. For us, it's more comfortable. You know, it's a mature, profitable company. And for our employees, for sure, I mean, they're just employees. So they could say back and forth, it's none of my concern, but it's very easy to feel the impact of every passing month for you, especially given seasonality. And this was really heartbreaking, yeah, to push and to really feel like it's just unreasonable. And we were very surprised because usually things go much more smoothly and, you know, you have timelines for a reason and it's adhered to. But we were so caught off guard by this loophole that turned out. And since we were so over-invested sort of emotionally into this project working, it was really, yeah. This was, I know how much time I spent in the regulatory team at that time of like strategizing of how can we make this possible? What are means of getting this through? Yeah. Yeah, it was.
So we made it.
We made it. Yeah. And then you treated your first patient. So this was how many years into your development journey when the first patient
was in the clinical trials?
Yes. Yeah.
I think it was 2023. Yeah.
Time flies.
So much.
Yeah. Time flies.
First patient.
Yeah. Yeah.
But in the clinical trial, we couldn't see those people. It was all anonymous. Yeah. So they were numbers. Yeah. Yeah. So like we always wanted to see the results. Yeah. And in skin disease, also you have a lot of this before, after. Right. So, but it was really exciting. Also, you build this thing.
Yeah.
And you think everything works. But still, it's like now someone will be radiated.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And if we've screwed up,
yeah,
they might burn the skin.
Mm-hmm.
And we did everything like there's no, we think we thought of everything, but still, this is exciting. No one got burned. Yes, but still.
Of course.
And the results were really amazing, like the improvement of quality of life and the patient satisfaction. And even though we couldn't talk to those people due to the pseudonymic thing, it was like, yeah. Like it was a mix of, of course it helps. Yes. And on the other side, like, wow, but now it's real. Now it's real. And that gave us also the push then, you know,
right,
with the MDR to have patience for that and to convince the health insurance in the middle of our recession. We now have nine public health insurances who are covering it and that we have the next deals in the pipeline. Yeah. Nine public health insurances within the first year in the market.
Mm.
We have 40 dermatologists now signed under contract. 40 dermatologists. As a patient, I need to wait half a year to get an appointment. And yes, we want more, of course, everything. And why do we want more? Because it brings more impact to the people. But it was this initial, we worked so hard for that moment.
Right.
It's like, we need to celebrate it more. GCP Service is good at celebrating success. We need to learn from that.
This we learned through 20 years.
For every listener, the Innovita team loves to be at GCP Service summer and Christmas parties. But it's also a good quality of an institution to, you know, you work so hard for goals and then also say, okay, we're ambitious, but maybe this evening or this day, let's appreciate that we finally made it.
Yeah. This is, and I know this for myself, there are things you work really hard for and then they happen. And a week after you realize, actually it happened. And I never even paused for a moment because I knew like long ago as this was approaching that this is what's going to be just a stepping stone for the thing that comes after and the thing that comes after and the thing that comes after. And, being mindful also of those positive moments is indeed something that I think just takes time to get into your head.
I totally agree. And I think this is really important also for mental health, especially for everyone who has a lot of enthusiasm and is really ambitious. Because for me, it was often like, we achieved it. And then I felt like, yes, of course we achieved it. I always knew we would achieve it, but I thought we would achieve it far earlier. So finally it is done and now we do the next thing. So... And force myself to be like, yes, you always knew that you would achieve it, but appreciate all the work. And now you deserve to do something. You reward yourself in any sense. We also privately talk a lot about these kind of things. And I think this kind of mental health and mindset topics are really, really important and really powerful. Even if you think as a even if you just want to think about productivity,
right,
then this is smart.
Yes, exactly.
To celebrate the successes.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You have a return on invest for doing things that you like in between as a reward.
Exactly.
For your hard work.
Exactly. Yeah. Yeah. And I know it's really easy to just, you know, brush over and say, I'll do it, I'll catch up. And there'll be a moment when, but I think we both know that that moment rarely happens unless you really put a focus on it and say, no, I will allow myself to pause and I will not feel bad for doing that. And then move on. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Very nice. So maybe from your product development journey and moving into the clinical trial. Now, the trial is, of course, essential to collect data. But behind that is the question, what type of data do I need? And there are various different requirements and sources of information. Of course, you have some regulatory requirements. And, you know, at the end of the day, it turned out you got your CE certificate without needing formal data. But you also use the data for health insurances, and you can use the data for investigators or doctors that you want to convince of your product. So how did you sort of like frame the question starting and moving into the clinical trial of what type of and level of information do we need to collect? And in hindsight, would you say there were any things that you might have missed now that you were using and leveraging that data that you could have collected at the time?
Good question. I think it has two stages. The first thing is when initiating it, you need to know why. Like, why do you even do it? Like, this is obvious for us. We saw a very high likelihood that we will need data on clinical on safety, because we take a professional therapy and bring it to the home environment. Yes, there was some kind of cases in which home therapy was already there, but from our risk perspective, it wasn't safe to just put a professional therapy lamp to patients' home and let them do whatever they want. What about kids in the household who could activate the lamp? What about overdose, etc.? So that was the anchor point. But doing clinical trial is also a lot of effort. So if you do it anyways, think of what are the easy wins of data you can also get and then use for other purposes. So the secondary endpoints, etc. And later we realized how valuable they are. So that was the first stage, was intentionally doing something, but also retrospectively seeing, oh, there's another data point. And since we had a software product, we also had a lot of data that needed to be there for the product to function. The two things we realized is really valuable. One thing was we tracked the adherence.
Right.
And it was about patients, if they do their treatment or not. And then we stumbled across one thing, which was, and that was not a main endpoint, we stumbled across, okay, but at which hour of the day do they actually do it? And we had it. I mean, every therapy session had a database entry. And then we analyzed this and then realized that 92% of the sessions were done outside of the typical clinic opening hours. And that later was such a good proof to show that we can reach different target groups, because the majority of our target group cannot go to a dermatology center during working hours. It sounds so logical, but with that data we were so much more convincing than of course for the certification side. It took time, but it went through very smooth, so the safety data was fundamental. But also on other levels, it was, that's what we realized with customers, especially with health insurances. For instance, statistical data on the improvement of life quality. For me, it was always so logical. It's like, of course it improves life quality. Just think about it. There is a patient, imagine a single mom who has a full-time job. How should that person go 25 times to a dermatology center 4 times a week during the opening hours?
Right.
Of course, this improves life quality. But we realize it makes a huge difference that we can just say 82% of patients who receive Skin Vita have an improvement in life quality, and this is clinically backed. It made a huge difference. It makes it more credible.
Right.
And I also had a bias because I had the pain. I knew. But for other people, it's not so easy to relate to that. And also, you know, if you're in a big institution and you need to make significant decisions, especially at times where there's a recession, the healthcare system has a cost problem. It needs to be really convincing,
right?
And having high quality data and the trust in all these institutions. They take a lot of time, but there is trust that when there is a German clinical trial or like in Europe, that it is representative. That is powerful. When we internationalize, maybe we will also see that the fact that we did things here and people know how difficult it is, that I think it can also lead to an advantage in the future.
Right.
Because it's like a proof, like a quality sign that we have. Like a quality label. Yeah.
And when approaching the clinical trial, what regulators ask for more and more is for the perspective of the patient to also be considered. Now, you were basically wearing two hats there. At one point, you have a product, you want data that really supports the marketing or market readiness of the Skinvita device. On the other hand, you also understand that as a patient, and like, or you know, from the perspective of a day-to-day application, you can only ask so much of a patient. So you would know that, well, we want home treatment, so we cannot ask for this or in this frequency, and you know, we need to give some leniency. So how was there ever a point where you felt like you were pushing the boundaries of how much you should ask of the patients that are joining in the trial and donating their time and their data to you and your cause? Was that more challenging for you, or was it easier for you because the positive impact of the treatment is something that was so easy for you to grasp yourself that it made it easier to say, no, the benefit is clearly there. And the donation of data, even if it's additional assessments that we do in our clinical trial, is something that's well worth it. I know this because I would also want to donate more.
Yeah. I think being a founder and a patient, or no, in health tech and a patient, or like a healthcare provider, or just being a founder and at the same time a person who has experienced a problem is a big advantage. So also, like, I think therefore we've been really consistent on the patient side to max out their what they need. And I think a lot of startups fall really much in love with their product. But to be honest, how I perceived it and many others, like as a patient, you just want to live your life. How many people are passionate about brushing their teeth? We still do it for health, you know, but you want to be empowered to live your life and be healthier. So therefore, we had a very consistent line of giving people freedom in their daily life and not overdoing it, but rather being on point. What do people need? And with the clinical trial, I think we've been also quite mindful about that. Of course, we needed data. But when we compared it, like in the clinical trial, patients could already do it at home.
Right.
So there was like maybe filling out some paper sheets versus 25 times driving to a clinic back and forth.
Yeah.
And there we could comfortably say, people want it. And if there's someone who would rather do the other, they will never be our target group, because then they don't have a problem to drive to the clinic. And this is okay. It's great for patients who live next to a clinic and feel most comfortable. They're great.
Right.
There is still one thing with being the patient and founder. It's always very important to see that you're not so much thinking that you have the most representative opinion or position. And this is something I think in life that happens a lot. Oh, I think it's like that because it is for everyone who has this problem. And therefore, it was really important to talk to other patients and to get feedback there. I think this is a bias and a risk that you have as a patient founder, that you make it so much then about your personal perception of the problem that might not be representative to others.
Right. That's a powerful perspective I didn't think about.
Yeah, you need to be critical to yourself that one.
And that can be tricky, because it's also, I mean, this is what you live and breathe every day. And that's not because you're patient, but it's also because it's like it's your entire life. You're a startup founder, so obviously it's your entire life. And so I think it's easy to sort of like get sucked up and think no one has spent more time thinking about this problem, but it's still in your head and it's from your perspective.
Yeah.
Would you, sort of thinking back about where you are now, not only having had clinical like trial patients, but also patients outside. And maybe as an anecdote, if I recall correctly, you hand delivered the first device to the patient once you got your CE certificate. Do I remember that correctly?
All the first devices were hand delivered. I don't know if it was the very first, because maybe someone else hand delivered it.
Okay.
But I really wanted so, and all the first devices were hand delivered. We also started in our hometown Bremen with the AOK, so the Bain Health Insurance here in the region. It was a privilege to do that. And you know, I was really nervous. The other person didn't know. So for her, it was like, oh, now my therapy device arrives. I was like, oh. So many years. I ring that bell and I don't know who opens the door. And So Nira was like, and she didn't know who I was.
Yeah.
For her, maybe I was the logistics guy who just brings the package. Was so wonderful. I was like, hey, my name is Jan. I'm from Skinevita. I am here with the therapy device. She was so happy. She invited me for a tea. So, and this happened a lot. We got invited for so many teas and coffee, and people were so, and they loved to hear everything, and they appreciated it a lot, and then brought like nice reviews. So this was such a rewarding experience.
I can imagine, yeah. And
I loved it.
Yeah, it turns it from like an idea into a reality. You mentioned it. It's in the clinical trial, it felt weird. And that very much resonates to me. I mean, for years I have analyzed data as a statistician. Yeah. So you see just, you know, subject ID, subject ID, subject ID. That's it. You don't really see the person behind it. The first time I got a call from the daughter of a patient that wanted to participate in a clinical trial that we were managing as a sponsor, that made it so personal that there's a person on the other side. And of course, I took all the time they needed to discuss options, what was possible and was not possible. So I can resonate that for you, suddenly, rather than seeing numbers on a screen and in a database, you see a patient on the other side and you see a smile when someone receives something which will improve its...
Yeah. It loads it emotionally. So
yeah.
Also, like, we have a really, really high satisfaction rate. But sometimes things don't go perfect. And it's like, oh, man. I really gotta solve this. We need to be better in that and that. But it's such a strong why.
Right.
And it's such a strong reminder. And I think I should tend to deliver some more devices now again. Like, because I love it. It's also part of the journey. Some things are also connected to hard work, but some things is part of the founder experience. That at least once you have to sleep in the office and do an all-nighter, at least once you have to screw up a pitch. At least once you have to do something really embarrassing. It's all part of the journey. Yeah. And it might, I think some things might be discomforting, but this is what you choose.
Right.
Yeah. Maybe I would even feel like a bit of imposter if things were too easy. Like this is like, yeah, this is part of the whole experience. All ups, all downs, the whole thing.
Did it become real for you when you handed it the first time over? And did you, at that, was that a point where you said, okay, now this is a success? And maybe let me preface that. Do you feel already that this is a success? Because I know that sometimes that can be really, really hard, a point really hard to connect to. Do you feel like a success? And was this a part that made it easier for you to grasp?
So that moment was really, really fundamental. It was really important for me because it was a milestone. It was a kind of success to be there, but it was kind of always the minimum expectation to help at least one person, like with all these things in there. So that was really great. Do I think it is a success? This is a really good question. It comes, I think it's close to this kind of celebrating achievements, etc. I would rather say we will be a success, and I'm 100% convinced of that. But I see homework. Probably I will always see it, so it's a bit risky. But we're a startup, we're fresh in the market, we're not profitable yet. So we cannot self-sustain. And I think this is another minimum requirement of a company to be a success. I mean, yes, there are so many startups who are not profitable for 20 years.
Right.
But for us, this is our ambition. And then I thought about this also a lot with the patients. Now I see all the patient numbers and we want more because it's more impact, but then when is it so we're profitable, and when is it enough patients or enough insurances or enough happy reviews that it is enough? So it's that it's a success, because you can always do more, and that's our ambition. We like at least until mm-hmm. we have served mm-hmm. everyone, until this problem doesn't exist right. anymore, then definitely would be a success. But in between, I think when this company, the next thing will be if it's when it's break even, and then the next thing is from all the public funding and investment that came in, that in terms of what we make of revenue, that we there also reach the neutral point. I'm also someone, we received public funding, and often I see people criticizing taxation and other mm-hmm. things, but my ambition is also to repay in terms of taxes as a company minimum everything that we have received, rather more to appreciate the public dedication we got, and to give the public the opportunity to fund other projects. And then I would see it as a like, then I think then we're there. But yeah. Probably then I will invent more things and say like, exactly. And now this and this and this, but then it's a success. So
very likely to happen, and we can recall this conversation by that time and think like, maybe you can recall like a year or two back when we had this conversation that this was going to be your goalpost and you moved it again. But I really appreciate just the thought and character behind the consideration. Hey, we got a chance was given to us. The minimum we have to do is repay that what was given to us. And yeah, I know you are very active also on the scene, and you're very supportive of new startups. So you're doing a lot to pay it forward beyond anything that can be measured in financial transactions. So yeah, I know you are without a doubt anyway leaving a mark. So this should, from an external point of view, not be your measure of success, but I can understand how you got to it. Awesome. So maybe seeing sort of the point of getting a CE certificate and then beyond, where did you see for yourself as developing a medical device for the European market, where did you see the biggest challenge running up to the CE certificate, and how has that changed since? Because I'm sure it's almost incomparable before or after in terms of the focus mm-hmm. of regulatory compliance and structure. How would you see those two, and where were the hurdles before and after?
Yeah, it's like a light switch. It's so different, because before you cannot do anything. This is the one thing you need for so many other activities. So that was so fundamental. And if that fails, that's it. Like, same with the clinical trial. If you're early stage startup, you don't really have a second shot. Like, I don't know if we could have had a second shot. Maybe, I don't know. But there's, like, it's so fundamental. So this is really crucial. And then the moment we got it, suddenly, now, many things, the limiting factor is that we get so many requests and have so many opportunities, but our person time is limited that we need to scale the company, but at the same time, it takes time for training, etc. So now it's rather we are the limit, becoming more the limitation.
Hmm.
Well, before it was hard cut. So now we're really free to do things. And of course, the regulatory journey is never over.
Hmm.
You need a good quality management system is something that needs to be lived. You always need to have the trainings in place, the risk analysis. We do software, every update needs to be evaluated.
Hmm.
And then, of course, you have the supervision audits. We just had our 1 year MDR supervision audit. And I expected, like, usually they always kind of find something. We had no non-conformities. Of course, we had some recommendations where they say, like, oh, you can do better here next time. Oh, I recommend this. But I was like, oh, cool. And, of course, now we will still take it serious. We should, as every device manufacturer, should always take it serious. But now it's more like on the quality management is say, okay, we know how it works. Now let's rather see when we scale the organization that we don't compromise on quality.
Mm-hmm.
But the focus you can be shifted on other, the main focus on other fields.
Right.
And that is the main difference. Mm. Until we want to re-enter in another market. So we haven't talked about FDA, all these things that probably is, again, like, you don't have the FDA mark, don't think about entering the US.
Exactly. Yeah, that's going to be its own challenge for sure. Mm. So do you think there is a secret ingredient for you to having passed so well with the quality audits? Or do you feel that it is risk appropriate, that since it's, you know, at the end of the day, it's a class 2A device, so there is only so much risk, so they should only put, like, the scrutiny is aligned with the risk classification? Or do you feel like you simply put yourself on exceedingly solid footings with your quality assurance?
Quality management system. A lot in quality management and also MDR, etc. A lot is just common sense. So we always started like, common sense, it will work. Then not understanding, then reading to it is like, we need to do all these things just for documentation. Mm-hmm. And then it's like a circle. You end up like, well, in the end, it is just common sense. So this is really interesting. So that is a point. What was the other edge of the question?
So for me, it was whether you feel it scales with risk class, whether you feel there is a certain regard to what you're doing because of your risk class, or if this is simply an after, like the complexity of your device, which puts it in a lower risk class, already means that it is, let's say, more common sense to develop a quality management system that's compliant, whereas when you have a really high risk device, of course you need to put a lot of effort in, which means it's also easier to find something that is not aligned.
I think that's rather a question for you, because I have experience with an MDR 2A product.
True.
I know a lot of software startups who came with class 1, then realized they need class 2A, and class 1, they basically gave themselves the approval.
Yes.
And then they struggled a lot because they were not complying anything, but were already on the market. And then it's really hard.
Rough.
It's like then installing in running process is really, really hard. But I do not have experience in the very high risk classes.
I see.
This is really interesting. I mean, I wonder if quality, I mean, it gets stricter, like when I think of quality management. But in the end, I mean, the importance of clinical data is even higher. But when it is there, it is there. And then it comes down to risk benefit evaluation, which then where I see this is so common sense. What is benefit? Yes. What is the risk? Would a person with a, you know, a common sense say the benefit outweighs the risk with the given data? So I think this is a principle that is true for every risk class. But what do you think?
No, I mean, in general, it's true. But probably, you know, if you have a 10-year implantable device that maybe has an energy source, it's, I think it's also quite apparent that you will have a lot more boxes to take in terms of your risk management profile. And even then, your quality management, like your effort put into the quality management system, should be risk proportionate. So if you already find a good avenue to say, well, technically we have a lamp which is not ours, so it's just an energy source there, and this is how we technically control it, and the rest is the software, it reduces, your software wouldn't be class 2A. It's class 2A because there is a lamp which is 2A. And so I think innately what you're producing has a very low risk footprint. And so I would also be surprised if there was a lot of scrutiny given. I would feel it's disproportionate to how much of an impact you can have on
our case. It just made sense, like from the very beginning, because the risk was very foreseeable. Like it was already like strict interpretation that we go into that risk class. But for other things, also especially like if you go into drug development, etc.,
right.
You don't really know the outcome.
Yeah.
I have big respect for all these stage one, stage two.
Yeah.
Like that's a real science. Big respect for that.
Mm.
And there it's a far more difficult evaluation. We work with a therapy that already existed.
Right.
This is not easy. Yeah. Big respect for the pros in there. Our secret sauce was to not be fully by ourselves, but to learn from people who are doing it. And then maybe talk to another person who's doing it. Hey, do you also see it like that? Okay. And then drafting it together. Like that was our secret sauce, to learn from others and have them kind of in the same journey.
Yeah. Well, congratulations on passing it so well.
Yeah.
So one of the things that you've been addressing is health insurances, how you have now partnered with 9 of them. But also, I think, and this was fun recently, because we have those discussions at the moment in Germany. And I think now the comment was, well, we have 92, 93 health insurances in Germany. Maybe we should go back to 10. And it's like, well, you realize this when you're at 90. Why didn't you comment on this when you were at 50? And why do we even need 10? What's that number? So for you, this has very practical implications, because it means these are all individual discussions, or largely individual discussions, I guess, that you have to lead from a reimbursement point of view. So I guess a lot of the post-market journey for you revolved around finding footing with health insurance companies. Mm. How did you, because also I'm assuming you had no prior contact points, like you had no prior experience, you didn't broker like health insurance deals for 10 years. So how did you start approaching it? And what do you feel in hindsight now is the key to starting that journey for other medical device companies out there that say, hey, this is the challenge that will come up for you after you hit your CE mark?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, this is a good point. We didn't have my co-founder Janina did an internship in an insurance, so at least a little bit, and we had great connections to the chairs for public health. And thanks to that, we got some contact to local health insurances. That was something, but in a point where it was about the scholarships until we had a certification, years have passed. That some things that worked for us and that didn't work. And of course, the fact that there are 92, are we at 92? It changes. Now there are a lot of mergers. 90-something public health insurances doesn't make it easier. it's also not like everything or nothing situation, at least. But 10 would make it a lot easier, especially because they have different market shares. And if you have a doctor who wants to prescribe you, there are 90 options. And you have one. Hard for the doctor to have a high probability that is that specific health insurance if it's not one of the larger ones. What did not work and that was frustrating was like just writing email and saying like, hey, we have a great solution. Take time. Let us pitch to you to like a contact that didn't know us. It was so frustrating. And there's still some insurances who never took the time to talk to us. Or to look at it. And this is a start of it. So, but it's so good. let me talk to you why it's good. but there are also other things that work really well. Generally, in the stage where we had really literally no contacts, I think going on pitch events was really good. I mean, that also means you have to go on stage. You will be also measured across other startups. But there are pitch events where those innovation managers are in the jury or in the audience. That really worked. And then finding people who can do intros to the right people at the health insurances. So these matchmakers. And this was also really important for our mentorship, but also for the investment journey that we saw. Maybe we can get business angels on board who know people in the health insurance world. What they're doing is not so much, it's just like, hey, have you considered what's going to be done? It's worth taking half an hour to listen to them. That's everything. Two lines of text or so, but then have the opportunity to talk to the right people. Right. And then they might still decide not that it might not make sense for them. That makes sense for everyone, but I have the opportunity to get in. So people who do intros, really important, and pitching on stage and not being afraid of going on stage and talking about your idea.
Well, you have definitely a lot of experience with that and a lot of exposure to it. So
there were, I think, definitely more than 100 pitches on stage, minimum. More, well, but it becomes normal.
Yeah, that's normal. So, what's installed for the future of SkinVita then? Now that you have your CE mark, first health insurances are in there. Of course, you know, there's about 80 still left. Or maybe you're aiming for like mid-50s or something like that. And maybe then you say, okay, it's good enough for now.
Never good enough.
true. But sort of what's next?
I said that earlier. So we have one specific problem for patients, and this is for a certain severity of the disease. And even though there is some optimization in the software, you always update, you always see how you can improve it, and you track it, and you have your KPIs. This is good. But generally, the majority of the problem solution fit is there. And now the next stage is to see. We have the patient population. We get requests from patients with all different kinds of severities. So right now we have also some patients who need a different treatment, and that's well justified. I'm happy for the large range of treatments that are there. But what we will do next is to expand on this stage so that we offer a suitable solution through the whole patient pathway, from educating yourself, how can you adapt your lifestyle and live a healthy life that will have a positive impact on your disease, to getting a quick prescription for the topical, the cream that you need, without waiting for months, but maybe you could get it within a day via telemedicine. Then if the cream doesn't work, phototherapy, already have that. And if you have a really, really severe case and need the injection, you find all your documentation and assistance and guidance in there, in the digital ecosystem that we already developed. And then there's so many other ideas that we could do from, I don't know, B2C, hey, you want bath salts, because bath salts is really good to get rid of your plaques, you can order that, or maybe some supplements, and but so many ideas, we need to structure it. And I think on the medical side, that's where we really see, because we have the certification now,
right?
This is also kind of our competitive advantage, that we now say, we don't go on the broad thing, that we're the right solution for every dermatologist, every disease. We will not be nail fungus or the pimple is not our focus, right? But for those diseases, we want to be the very best. And then not just only in Germany, but also across borders.
Yeah, that comes with new requirements, new journeys into different regulatory spheres, which, again, I'm sure the team that has now sort of like settled in the German ecosphere will be happy, maybe to a certain extent, that again, there's a journey to jump into. But I mean, they've managed this very well so far, so that'd be great. Awesome. And do you see that in Germany now, since you sort of like opened for a lot of intents and purposes, the let's say home care market in Germany, especially for phototherapy? I mean, that's where you really pushed open a door. At the same time, currently, you know, we have a lot of discussions around how can we restructure our healthcare system here in Germany? How can we reduce costs a lot? Which means that a lot of things are sort of on the chopping block or are going to be reconsidered. How do you see that larger space develop? Where do you see the future of German healthcare? Let's say not at large, but maybe in terms of dermatology. Do you see that there's going to be significant shifts based on the discussions that we have, or do you feel it's mostly going to move around you?
Yeah, there will be big shifts, and they're already happening right now, and the situation is already really bad, and the fundamental problems will get worse. One thing is the demographics. We have also a lot of dermatologists, more than 30% are about to retire within the next 5 years. So the density of specialists is reducing. And at the same time, we have this cost problem. So and often this leads to higher costs. If there's no access to a certain treatment, then the expensive drug is the only solution, and it's, you know, the fast way you could go. And this is a general topic, I think, for the whole German healthcare system and most healthcare systems, I think, in the West. And how can you solve it? I mean, technology is the main opportunity we have to see that you bring in more effectiveness. And this is where all the AI tools are so important for early detection, and prevention will be increasingly important. Then let's talk, for instance, in mental health, for instance, if there's a waiting time, 4 months for a therapist, if you give someone at least something, an app they can work with, it doesn't replace the therapist, but at least they have something. Like, these kind of solutions are good. And this is also what we see. And then if you go one step further for physical treatments, there also, if there's an opportunity to do it from home and save capacities at the doctor's office, which can be used for other really needed purposes, then it makes sense. Like, I think the insurance currently talk a lot about digital before ambulant, before stationary. So they kind of set up certain structure where digital will be the first thing. Then you will maybe go to a doctor, preferably via telemedicine, And then the very, very last point is to go to a clinic or do something that requires a lot of resources that's necessary in a time where resources are the main constraint.
Mm-hmm. You briefly touched upon the topic of artificial intelligence. Now, you sort of, and I really appreciated that consideration also from yourself, you didn't fall into this, you know, a couple of last years. It would have been easy for you to say, but we're an AI first, you know, a company, like many others have, and especially in the startup sphere, because this was associated with higher company valuations, maybe more interest from investors and so on. What do you see in terms of your own development as well, especially since you mentioned that from your initial product and problem that you're solving, if you want to branch out and become more of an ecosystem, now it might make sense to sort of reconsider exactly how you position yourself and how much you use software and artificial intelligence to enhance that journey, provide information, I don't know, do image analysis and saying like, this is this type of, you know, skin disease and you can use this or that treatment. This is how we would recommend. Are there any considerations you yet have in terms of how you would develop in that direction?
Yeah, that's really interesting. AI is one of the biggest opportunities we have, especially in healthcare, especially when you talk about big data, and this is massive and really good. Still, I think you should never lose the problem focus and the center. It's like a few decades ago, we're an internet company, an internet first company. Like, it's a tool. And that's also how I see it. It's a powerful, massive tool that can bring effectiveness in so many productivity, in so many levels of every organization. And then also in the medical side to improve. And of course, for us, image analysis and therapy projections will be a major role. Also, different kinds of analysis, how a treatment plan can be adapted, or a probability if a side effect will occur in 3 sessions if the treatment plan is not changed, or giving patients like a visual clue how probably their skin will look over the course of the weeks. Because in the first weeks, usually you don't have a lot of therapy effect, and then it really hits in, and then it goes.
Really?
Right? So there's a lot of things you can do, and this is wonderful, and we do it within the problem that we solve. And the main problem in phototherapy is driving 25 times, 4 times a week in total, to a clinic and needing to do it from home. And that we achieve mostly with telemedicine, and AI is the thing that can leverage and make it even better. But the problem is always the main thing. It will be the center, not the technology. It's solving the problem.
I love that. Because I think it's very easy to fall into an opportunity trap where you say, well, AI is a solution to everything, so let's just, you know, slap it on everything. But as long as you are, and it's very clear and very apparent from our conversation also, you're so focused on ensuring you don't lose track of your problem, that it will make it easy for you to see the opportunities of leveraging it, or also not feel remorse over not leveraging it, because it simply doesn't address the core problem that you want to solve, and that you are solving. So maybe a couple of closing questions. First one would be, if you got the opportunity to enact any one policy, which policy would you like, political in nature, or, you know, for our, the way that our healthcare system is shaped, which one would you enact to, I guess in this case, address your core problem, or for you yourself or other companies to have an easier path? Which one would you?
I think in general, for our society and the medtech community, a mandatory policy that between the submission of, for instance, an MDR application, and when the notified body starts reading it, they have a certain deadline. And just that will not be the solution, because if you don't have enough notified bodies, then it will not, it's impossible. But this is the main problem. It doesn't provide any value to anyone if between submission and the point in time when someone starts reading it, like, it's literally just there, like nothing happens. That needs to be shortened. I think this is so important because it will boost innovation without any harm of anyone. It should be a priority to speed that up.
Right.
And if the submission is bad and if a product is bad, it's okay. But look at it when it is submitted. Startups die during the waiting time. That doesn't make sense. That's the one main thing I would drive forward. Apart from that, there's so many things, but this dominates everything.
Okay. I can feel that this is then also the key pain point that they had really in the journey here, that wasted year, so to speak.
Yeah.
Where like, we are ready, let's have a conversation, let's move things forward. And you idled for 12 months.
Yeah.
And you were early with reaching out to 105buzz. It's one of the things that, you know, we always say when we are engaging with startups. The waiting time for your notified body will be the rate limiting factor in vast majority of cases. So don't wait until you have a product. Get in early, have those conversations early, involve them early, get contracts ready with them. Don't wait with selecting a notified body until you're ready, because it's just going to take a lot of time for them to respond. And you were early, and still there was a lot of wait time. And I know how hard you pushed and how persistent you had to be at the end of the day to try and get things to work. And
we called every day. We wrote SMS with three people in the end. Was before Christmas, because they it was exactly 1 year ago, and we knew if Christmas happens that they will also disappear.
Yeah.
And they promised, and they did promise, but they announced us that has, which were already gone. And in the end, we were so annoying. And that is what was needed, because we were right.
Yeah. I mean, I know that's not, like, it's difficult because you have to be something you don't like doing, but it was pivotal for you as a company. It was pivotal for the success and for your survival, frankly speaking. So, yeah, you have to do what you have to do to make the company survive. Yeah. Jan, give me one thing that gives you hope. This is a very...
The enthusiasm of people I see around me. There's so many people who have so much enthusiasm. It's seeing that while in the news you see wars and crisis and whatever. But the real thing I see that gives me a lot of hope. There's so many people who want to create great things.
I love that answer. I truly love that answer. Anything else you want to touch upon that we haven't touched upon before we wrap up?
I want to say thank you. This was really fun. This, I think it's also the first episode.
True.
As a guest, this is a really fun podcast. I hope as a listener it is as well. And thank you for the close partnership we have since so many years. Thank you for the friendship also. And I'm looking forward to what comes in the future.
Thank you, Jan. It was an absolute pleasure.